Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Nursing Home and Hospital Patient Safety Initiative, Pressure Ulcer, Ask the Expert. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, you may press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host today, Maureen Valvo. Please begin.
Good morning. I'm Maureen Valvo from the iPro office. With me also is Pauline Kinney, Dan Juracek, and Gloria Stone. Good morning and welcome to our presentation. We appreciate you joining us for this morning's conference call, which is part of a series of educational offerings addressing pressure ulcer prevention and treatment in hospitals and nursing homes. Today is an Ask the Expert session. A program evaluation form was forwarded to you and is available on Jenny's site. Please fill out the evaluation form and send it back to iPro at the number on the bottom of the page. As a reminder, this conference call session is being taped, and we will post it on Jenny's website, and it will be accessible for future review. We will send out the link to everyone when the recording becomes available. As mentioned, all of your lines are currently muted, but following the initial questions, there will be an opening for your additional questions and comments and further discussion. We're very pleased to have with us Dr. Mona Baharistani, Dr. Joyce Black, and Dr. Jeffrey Levine as our guest speakers today. In the interest of time, we included their bios in our emails, and they are available on the Jenny website. So please join me in welcoming our speakers. We are going to begin with the questions you originally submitted. The first was, how should we score blood blisters on the heels? There's a debate that it should be a stage 2, as it is a blister. But others say because it dries up, there's a blackish covering, and it should be staged as stage 4. Dr. Mona?
Yes, good morning. I'm going to address this question and would suggest that the callers also refer to the National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel website, which would be npuap.org. As you open up that website and scroll down to the bottom, you will actually find a statement made by the National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel to address this particular issue. It's the recommendation of the National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel that blood-filled blisters secondary to pressure be staged as unstageable / stage 4. These particular pressure ulcers, because they are blood-filled, it actually obscures your ability to see what is at the base of these ulcers. Obviously, a serum-filled blister that is secondary to pressure, so a pressure ulcer presenting as a serum-filled blister would still be staged as stage 2, but blood-filled, the recommendation at this point in time from the National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel is to code it as unstageable. Dr. Black, I don't know if you have,
I have a question for you.
Add.
If you don't mind, I'd just like to jump in because is this a change?
Yes.
Because the last I heard from NPUAP was that the blood blisters were considered to be deep tissue injury. And I'm also questioning the issue of the slash because it sounds like you're adding a seventh stage here with a double stage. So if you could kindly address that, I'd
appreciate it. Dr. Levine, you are correct. The National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel does, in the description of suspected deep tissue injury, include maroon, purple, intact skin as deep tissue injury, blood-filled blister secondary to pressure and or shear as deep tissue injuries. But as you're aware, in MDS, they do not acknowledge deep tissue injuries.
Right.
For example, if we had a purple intact maroon area, the MDS at present does not acknowledge this is a deep tissue injury, not having that as a category. So the National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel, in that particular case, the recommendation is to code that as a stage 1. Sorry, Dr. Black, you were going
to... Oh, that's right. I was waiting to see if there was another follow-up question on that. Yeah, as I read the question, I believe that the writer was writing from a long-term care setting where they're forced in the MDS to pick stages 1 through 4. And that's the reason the NPOAP created the document that you'll find on the website, was recognizing that the MDS 2.0 has not been changed to the 3.0 version yet, nor do I think it's going to come out until next year. And so when we realized there was going to be a delay in getting the MDS 3.0 out for long-term care, we figured we'd best be helpful to give some advice on what you do with deep tissue injury. And so as Dr. Baharastani described, if you stage what you see, if you see purple intact skin, you stage it as a 1. If you see a blood blister, you stage it as a 4 or unstageable, either one. The difficulty is that there's a presumption that if you have a stage 4 wound ulcer, you're doing something about it. You're packing it, you're dressing it. And so it's very important in this instance, since there's nothing to pack as a typical 4, you be sure in your clinical notation that you describe the true blood blister, so there's no confusion if you're audited or reviewed for some other reason.
Well, just to clarify from, sorry.
Yeah, this is specifically for the coding of the MDS. One, of course, could and should, in their progress notes, be describing what it is that they see. But this is for MDS and the reimbursement component, and realizing that, unfortunately, we have limitations given that we're still, if in long-term care, dealing with the 2.0. So this does not apply to, obviously, the acute care setting.
Well, when would deep tissue injury apply to a blood blister of the heel, if ever?
That would be in acute care or in home care, where we can actually give appropriate descriptors. In long-term care, because of MDS, we are stuck with the situation as it currently lies with MDS. I mean, you're correct that a blood-filled blister secondary to pressure and or shear would be classified as a deep tissue injury outside of the confines of the MDS 2.0 staging system.
Thank you for that clarification.
You're welcome. As confusing as it is, it's again us trying to make an attempt to fit information into a system that, as Dr. Black said, will not be changing until 2010, if that. It was supposed to have changed to the 3.0 in October of this year, but obviously we know that has been delayed.
Next question, that was you have referred to it, but the question was shearing. Is it pressure or not? Do we stage all sheared areas as stage 2?
I think I can take that one. The NPUAP has been working with the European pressure ulcer group to try to identify and better understand the problem of shear. Shear is a difficult concept to understand because it occurs at superficial layers of tissue and it occurs at deep layers of tissue. When you see the new definition of pressure ulcers, you will see that, and the new definition will be the one you see in the guideline. The word friction is taken out as a cause of a pressure ulcer, and the word shear and pressure are the only etiologies or causes of the pressure ulcer that you'll recognize in the new definition. There are other causes of pressure ulcers, but shear is there. I think we're better understanding shear than we did before, and yes, we believe it leads to a pressure ulcer because shear is sort of an angled pressure. If you push your index finger down onto your palm straight down, that's pressure. If you tip your finger to the side to an angle and push at an angle, that's shear. So there, you can't have shear without a pressure component to it. I this answer to the second question if a sheared area is open, if you're looking at a pressure ulcer that has a flared edge to it, and you have a history in this patient of shear forces, which means the patient is sitting up in bed and sliding down, if it's open, yes, it's a stage two. Obviously, the staging system is meant to describe the depth of the wound based on the visible tissue present at the base of the wound. So all sheared areas will be twos, I think, at some point in their life, but they could certainly go on to be deeper wounds. So I don't know that I would absolutely say every sheared ulcer is a stage two. It probably is a stage two at some point, but you have to stage it based on what you see. And shearing certainly makes wounds worse. In my opinion, I think it leads to the extensiveness of a wound and causes them to enlarge across greater body surface. So I don't know that I'd call all staged, all sheared areas stage two. Do the other speakers have other thoughts on that? I'm sure that they do.
Go ahead.
Well, I would ask you to go ahead, Mona. Maybe you, we have the same question.
My comment there would be to agree with what Dr. Black has said and to further elaborate that when we see pressure ulcers secondary to shear, many times we're also seeing much deeper pressure ulcers, frequently with areas of undermine because of tissue displacement that has occurred. With pressure was described and then with shear forces, if we envision a patient who's, for example, lying in the bed and the head of the bed has been put up, or the patient who's sitting in the chair and who's sliding down, we can visualize what's happening with this person is that gravitational pull is taking the skeleton downward and taking the deep fascia with it. But our superficial fascia and our soft tissue is staying more stationary. So there's almost like a ripping effect occurring. We have tissue displacement occurring, and we have angulation of the capillary bed. So here we're seeing much larger pressure ulcers than those lying over the bony prominence. So it's bigger than the bony prominence over which it lies. And again, often we see areas of undermine. This is frequently typified by our deep tissue injuries. So I would agree that we would not say that all pressure ulcers that have shear as a component are stage two. In fact, many of these are going to actually be much deeper pressure ulcers.
I have a question for Dr. Black. Traditionally, we've been teaching our nursing assistants that when we turn and position patients and move them around in bed, we have to use the draw sheet rather than drag them across the sheet. And the purpose of that is to prevent pressure ulcers by eliminating friction. And now I'm hearing that friction is no longer considered to be part of the one of the factors that leads to pressure sores in the new guideline. And I was wondering if that's going to impact on the way and what we teach nursing assistants and nurses.
Good question. I guess I've taught the same thing for years, but I haven't looked at it as a huge component of friction management. The engineers that are on the panel talked about just the fact that friction leads to heat in the skin and leads to serum-filled blisters because of the separation of the layers of the epidermis and dermis against the underlying tissue, and that's what gives you the serum-filled blister. I haven't heard it talked about as far as a the effect of pulling the patient. But you're right, as you slide the patient across in bed, you do create a friction-like change in the surface of the tissue. So might be something we go back to the engineers on and ask them if they're confident that their decision on friction is one that's based only on laboratory stuff or based on clinical stuff. So it's a good question. Hadn't looked at it that way myself. Looked at it more as when we turn patients with a draw sheet as preventing pulling forces or shearing forces on the tissue rather than friction forces on the bed skin interface, but you bring up a good issue.
Thank you.
The next question I have is, does anyone have any experience with the True Turn Elite mattress from Gaymar? Our panel was beginning to discuss this just before we started the call. I don't know, Joyce, if you had specific experience. Otherwise, we could maybe ask the participants to discuss this when we open the lines, if any of them have used this product.
I actually don't have experience with this mattress, so I'm absolutely no help at all on this question.
I actually looked up some information on the Internet regarding the product because I don't have personal experience either. I saw in my review on the Internet, which was brief because you had to sign on and become a member and what have you to open the PDF, but I saw that it was listed as a low air loss therapy that also would assist the nurse when you press a pendant button. It would assist the nurse in achieving a 40-degree angle turn of your patient, which would assist in pulmonary benefits and for provision of wound care. But I don't have any personal experience with this therapy.
The only caution I think that we would offer in devices that are said to turn the patient is they're listed as assistive devices for turning. And I think people have to realize that what's happening in those beds is one side of the bed is deflating and the patient then is falling down. That's not the same as turning. When they fall to one side because the bed has partially deflated or the mattress has deflated on that side, the body shifted weight, so it helps with pulmonary problems, but the patient's skin didn't leave the surface of the mattress. It's really no different than when you try to get off a floating device in your pool. You aren't turning. You're falling to one side. So I think you have to be careful that people can assume that since they see the word turn in the mattress, that they don't have to turn the patient once they're on those kinds of devices. And it's true for, I've never looked at this one by Gaymar, but that's true for all surfaces that have the word turn in it, is it's easy to make the assumption that if the bed turns the patient, then the nurse doesn't have to. And that's not what these are trying to do. These are trying to assist you to get the patient started so it's easier to finish the turn and turn them up onto either side.
And we also have to consider the weight and distribution of the individual that's in the surface. While we may have certain body locations, and each one of us has, you know, we're weighted differently in different parts of our body, it may move to some degree. Maybe, as Dr. Black had said, the upper torso region, but then how does that impact the lower limbs? Will it totally offload the pressure, for example, from the feet? So that's another component to be concerned about when we, as healthcare professionals or ancillary staff, are physically, manually turning and repositioning our patients. We take into consideration the total patient, the total resident, and the need to offload.
The next question I believe you've begun to discuss, NPUAP had the staging system modified for 2 years. Long-term care is still using the old system. CMS does not recognize DTI. What should clinicians do? We seem to look foolish because we are redescribing wounds differently and need to in order to get reimbursed. Is there a timeline for implementation of universal language?
I'd like to start. I'm sure everybody has everybody on the panel is going to say something, and I'd like to address it. We're absolutely not foolish in the way we describe our wounds as long as we're describing them accurately. And it is true that we're kind of stuck with the MDS system. It's kind of an anachronism, really, but we need to deal with it. And I think we should code the MDS the way it's supposed to be coded, use the National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel system and be cognizant of it, and write good notes that describe just what we see.
I completely agree. You know, when NPUAP revised, updated the staging system, we knew that CMS was not going to follow along because we didn't have CMS involved in the initial work. It was the NPUAP staging system. So somebody had to start the process of change. We expected that CMS would follow along shortly, and the MDS 3.0 has been delayed. I have no idea why. I've seen some of the sections, and they look very, very good for a new federal document. But it's just a process of change, and I appreciate the frustration in the writer's voice about, you know, we got one document saying one thing and one document saying another. And Dr. Levine is right. Be sure that your clinical notes are current and correct, and the people who review your material will understand that you're stuck with an old nomenclature, an old system in the MDS 2.0.
I don't have anything to add there. Again, we just have to realize that the purpose behind the MDS and that there are going to be revisions, and use your progress note to fully describe that what you see.
The next question is, there seems to be a great deal of variation in the use of photographs. Some hospitals take pictures of all pressure ulcers that are present on admission. Some facilities take pictures upon admission and throughout the hospital stay, while others take pictures of hospital-acquired ulcers. Please discuss the pros and cons of using photographs as part of a pressure ulcer program.
Can I start on this one?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I think most of us in the industry know that litigation regarding pressure sores has been a growth industry amongst attorneys. And attorneys have perfected the art of using photographs as a shock value to increase the value of their cases in front of a jury. So facilities have responded by saying, well, we never take photographs because we're making exhibits for the attorneys who are taking us to court. Well, these days with digital photography and these portable digital cameras and cell phone cameras, if we don't take the picture, you can rest assured that somebody else will behind the curtain. So I recommend the use of photographs, but only within a strongly worded and a rigorously followed policy and procedure when we take photos and when we don't take photos, and that there's that the photos are taken uniformly across the board, and that staff, there are several staff that are involved with taking photographs, that there's cross-training so that if the person that usually uses the camera is out or is late, then someone else is going to pick up the ball and take the photograph. So, and I think that we learn from photographs because as clinicians, we look at our work and we see how things have progressed and whether they've progressed and if they've gotten worse, and we gather experience as far as what we should use and what we shouldn't be using in our facilities.
I would totally agree with Dr. Levine. There has been this turnaround of fear that if you take the photograph, it will be used in a court of law against you. But as Dr. Levine said, if you're not taking the photograph to describe that which the patient either presents with on admission or the progression of the ulcer, someone else will be taking the photograph, and it potentially might be at the point in time much after you've seen the patient. So the wound status could actually be even at the time of a patient's expiration. I would fully agree that you must do this within the confines of a policy and procedure. You need to be working with your risk management department and ensuring that there has been informed consent obtained for these photographs where at all possible from the patient and or significant others. If that's not possible and it is written within your policy and procedure, then it might be the medical attending who would provide permission, again, if this was consistent with your policy and procedure. I would suggest that you obtain two documents. One you could obtain actually by going to Google and just typing in photography of pressure ulcers, And in doing so, you will actually come up with a frequently asked question document from the National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel. Now, Dr. Black, you might know exactly where this is on our website, but I couldn't find it last evening, so this is how I obtained it. And it's entitled Photography for Pressure Ulcer Documentation. And, again, it is a document from the National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel. Our statement is not that we suggest that you photograph, nor do we say not to photograph, but simply to state if you photograph, here are recommendations and here are advantages and disadvantages. One of those disadvantages acknowledged in this document is that deep tissue injuries may not be evident on admission, and so your initial photographs may not actually capture the full extent or severity of the damaged tissue, so you do need to elaborate in your progress notes. Another document that you could be using is if you go to the WOCN website and you go into their search box on the right upper hand corner and just type in photography of wounds. You will have a professional practice document from the WOCN from that site as well. And the statement made by WOCN, they're neither recommending that you do nor do not photograph. They're simply making statements that, again, we would want to have policies and procedures in place, that we ensure informed consent, that we acknowledge HIPAA-related issues, and then they also bring forth issues raised by Joint Commission. So these, I think, are helpful documents, but photography needs to be standardized in your institution, and it needs to be in compliance with your institution's policy and procedures.
Great comments by the other experts on the call. The only thing I would add is that if you are fearful that the picture you take or the family takes of the pressure ulcer will be used in a court of law, fear not. There are other wonderful pictures and diagrams of pressure ulcers that are also used and are sometimes more horrific than the picture you had. I was involved in a court case in which the patient had a dime-sized, nickel-sized, 2-centimeter-sized, very small pressure ulcer. To me, it wasn't horrific at all. The jury nearly fainted when they saw it because it was built up to be such a huge wound, and without a measuring product in the wound, you couldn't even refer the jury to what they were looking at. As far as they were concerned, it was 25 centimeters across, and only with the clinical documentation was I able to explain the true size of that wound.
And that's what a good expert does, because these wounds to the lay public certainly are horrific to look at, and these are things that we as caregivers see on a day-to-day basis and we accept as being part of our day. So explaining these things to a jury is one of the jobs that an expert has.
One last comment, and realize, too, if you're using your photography as adjunctive to, which you should be, adjunctive to your documentation, your description of a pressure ulcer or any wound, realize the limitations when you take a photograph. If you need to capture as well underlying areas of undermine or tunneling, as was described, using maybe rulers beside of the wound or pressure ulcer, possibly having a cotton swab near areas of undermine or tunneling will be also assistive, and maybe even having markings on the skin to depict the underlying areas of undermine or tunneling that, again, a photograph is going to be limited in its ability to depict.
I have a question for the other panel members. I have seen photography substitutes in the form of sterile plastic see-through grids that you lay over the wound and trace the margins of the wound, and that then becomes part of the record. I was wondering if anybody has a comment on those products.
I've not personally used that in clinical practice. I know that some facilities have, again, to basically further quantify this is exactly, you know, the size and shape externally of the ulcer. One other point that I forgot actually to mention in that WOCN guideline is some degree of concern about, with digital photography, the ability to also manipulate images and to take that into consideration.
As far as the acetate tracings, they're used by several facilities to get a true surface area, you know, or the topography, the upper surface of the wound. I used those in my dissertation, and one of the problems I had almost every day was trying to see where the true edge of the wound was, because as it was healing, you know, the epithelium is flat in color, and the underlying tissue is shiny. That was the only thing I could use to distinguish the edge in some of those wounds, and then depending on how the patient was positioned, it was difficult to get a true reading. The heel in particular is very difficult to get an acetate tracing when the ulcer wraps up the back of the heel as well as on the plantar surface of the heel, because it's not a three-dimensional product. So there are some limitations to using the acetate tracings, but they do provide a pretty good measure of surface area, and therefore you could make a reasonable judgment that the wound is, you know, decreasing in size.
The next question is, please discuss the importance of patient-family education in the care and management of pressure ulcers. In addition, do you have any suggestions for resources for patient education materials?
I think I can start that one. I have noticed in talking with people from other countries that they rely very heavily on the family to actually provide some of the bedside care for their family members. Now, in some instances, it's because the person at bed rest is the money maker, the breadwinner for the family, and they need to get him back to work so the family can survive. In the States, it seems like many times we almost treat the family like they're a nuisance, and we avoid going in to see the patient while the family's there, and we, you know, delay all sorts of treatments because we don't want to discuss things with the family. I think we really need to relook at how we envision the family, and in today's short staffing situations in many facilities, we probably need to engage the family much more than we currently do. I honestly think it may reduce the number of pressure ulcer lawsuits we have if we could engage the family to help us with some of the care. I don't know of particularly good patient education. There are lots of patient education materials around. The majority of them seem to be made by local hospitals, local systems of care. Obviously, when you write patient education material, you need to make sure that it's written at a sixth grade level so that the patient and family can understand it and not just be more information given to them that they'll never understand what you're doing. But I do know that we don't do as good a job as we can engaging the patient and family in the healthcare debate, in the healthcare that we provide, and we could do a lot better job. Maybe Dr. Bahawastani or Levine know where we could get patient education material that's top-notch. I don't actually have any references to offer.
I would suggest the AMDA clinical practice guidelines as a resource. It's very thorough and well-written. It's not overly technical, and you can get a hold of this at the AMDA website, American Medical Directors Association.
I would also suggest that, for example, you could use a number of the companies that provide product for your institution. Granted, some of those you'll have to review each of the pamphlets that they may have available because they may be more product specific that may then not be appropriate for the patient and or family. But I know a number of the companies have more generic patient and family educational guides that might be helpful for utilizing. I still actually have hundreds and hundreds of copies of the old AHCPR patient and family educational booklet, so we're actually still giving those out. And as Dr. Black had mentioned, A number of institutions also have made their own very, very simple little booklets. I would further suggest that, yes, in the United States, we do need to do a better job in engaging our patients and our families with education, realizing that, you know, lay people very well, when they see an area of eschar, may think that that's a scab that's just going to fall off and everything's going to be okay. And then we'll be horrified as you were maybe using topical enzymes or hydrogels, or you perform sharp debridement, and then you unroof a stage 4 pressure ulcer, and then they get angry thinking you made something very benign worse. Or, you know, their lack of knowledge related to suspected deep tissue injuries, and they may not understand how something that was purple that they thought was only a bruise, you know, then evolves to expose a full thickness pressure ulcer. So I do also agree that we could decrease the number of lawsuits by engaging our patients and families in having a better understanding of how these ulcers occur and how they evolve. Actually, my doctoral work was actually in this particular area, and it was across the board that lay caregivers would say they just thought that area of, you know, that black tissue, which we know as eschar, they thought were scabs and were normal and fall off, and, you know, everything would be okay underneath. So we can't assume that lay people have the same degree of knowledge that we have, you know, from our education.
And I would add, let's bring the doctors into the loop. I think doctors need to be educated as well. Frequently, the examination of skin and turning a patient over and looking at their buttocks and their heels is not part of the doctor's physical examination. So we need to bring the doctors in to teach them pressure ulcer assessment, skin assessment, and how to explain risk factors to family members.
That's an excellent point, and even other healthcare providers outside of medicine, maybe in practice areas where they don't typically see the high risk, or they haven't acknowledged the potentially high risk individual for a pressure ulcer, like OBGYN, other areas where it's not their usual to have the high risk population, but they need to always be on the alert and watching for that patient presentation of pressure ulcers.
The next question is, please discuss the role of the physical therapist in the care and management of pressure ulcers.
I think I can start this one. I think the physical therapists have a very important role in prevention and in treatment. In prevention, obviously, the quicker we can get patients ambulatory, the less risk they hold. Physical therapists are also great at improving just bed mobility in patients so that they can lift and turn themselves and move themselves in bed. We use our physical therapists in acute care in patients that have range of motion difficulties or are comatose and don't have the obviously the ability to do their own, to move themselves. We also use our physical therapists in acute care for wheelchair seating cushions for high-risk patients and for patients that are ulcerated. Many facilities use physical therapists for the treatment of pressure ulcers. They do the debridements and dressings and local wound care and the sometimes the adjunctive therapies with electrical stimulation and ultrasound and those kinds of things. So they seem to have a broad interface with pressure ulcer prevention and care, at least from my view of the world. I'm sure that the other panelists today also engage their physical therapists and maybe have slightly different roles they could expand on.
In the New York metropolitan area, I've had physical therapists as part of the team when delivering whirlpool treatments. And another facility I worked in, the physical therapist did the electrostim treatments. I'm not sure everybody would agree that electrostim is helpful, but nonetheless, the physical therapists were involved with doing that. I'm also aware that there's large regional variations in the United States with regard to what physical therapists are credentialed to do. I know that in parts of the American Southwest, I've I've seen physical therapists actually doing sharp debridements and scoring of the cross-hatching of eschars and before the application of an enzymatic debriding agent. This, I think, would be pretty much unheard of in the New York metropolitan area, but I don't know what's, you know, I'm not that cognizant of what's gone into the credentialing of physical therapists in debridement. I know that probably wouldn't fly around my hospital in the places I've worked.
You are correct. I mean, you do see geographical variation in the role of the physical therapist in wound care. I know, for example, in the states of California and like Louisiana, because we have many internationally known colleagues who are physical therapists and wound specialists, they actually may be the very lead people on the wound care team. Physical therapists serve as educators in wound healing and, you know, pressure ulcer prevention and treatment. You know, on our National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel, we have physical therapists. They, as Dr. Black had said, can very wonderfully assist us as far as in the role of seating specialist, especially with our patients with spinal cord injuries, in looking at appropriate also tilt in space wheelchairs. They could be assistive for us in looking at offloading, like with splints and maybe C-collars. They're really critical players as far as being, you know, interprofessional team players. As far as the component of debridement, and I'm not a physical therapist, so I mean, I'd have to look at their practice act, but I know that that is within the scope of practice of physical therapists, whether there is geographical variation in those privileges or not, I'm not certain. So I don't know if it's an issue of that they're privileged different by state, or is it that the state doesn't have them involved as much. So I don't know. We'd have to look at, you know, state practice acts as far as physical therapist and debridement. But I know in many states they are the ones doing the sharp debridements pre and post whirlpool therapies and making recommendations as far as the prevention of and treatment of pressure ulcers as well as all types of wounds.
And I'm glad you brought up the seating issues, because I think physical therapists frequently are underutilized in the expertise that they could bring the team with regard to seating cushions and appropriate seating in wheelchairs, which is extremely important with our wheelchair-bound patients, our neurologically impaired patients, and our patients with severe dementia who can't leave the wheelchair.
Yeah,
well,
good point.
Our whole support surface initiative through NPUAP, really our physical therapists were at the helm of that, because, you know, pressure redistribution, sleep surface technology, and pressure redistribution in the chair is so much a part of their knowledge base. So they are critical players.
The next question is, what data do you recommend to collect for a pressure ulcer program? Is it prevalence data that's the most important to look at?
I would say all components. I mean, prevalence, you know, tells you about newly acquired as well as existing ulcers, those that you may have admitted to your facility, coupled with those that developed within the facility. It is important to have that data so that you know what is the scope of the need, the population that you're serving in your institution, but incidence or facility-acquired prevalence data is also important, because that speaks to the number of pressure ulcers that have developed within your institution, and then can lead you to do root cause analysis to see, had you done everything that you could for this particular patient, had you followed your policies and procedures, were these unavoidable or were they avoidable pressure ulcers? So I think all these types of data are important.
Next question is, please discuss the role of the emergency department in the care and management of pressure ulcers.
I think we all have something to say. Dr. Levine, you wanted to start?
Oh, sure. I can start on this one. Thank you. Well, the most emergency rooms are geared to deal with acute situations, and I think the mindset of most people who work in the emergency room, in their mindset, pressure ulcers aren't one of those things. But we need to in-service, number one, start with in-servicing all emergency room personnel, and even the people that are the EMTs that bring the patients into the emergency room. They need to be in-serviced as far as documentation, skin inspection, skin assessment, and proper documentation. Past this, all surfaces need to be looked at for appropriate pressure relief. In many emergency rooms across the country, where in situations where there is a shortage of beds, of inpatient beds, it's very frequent that patients sit around in the emergency room for 8, 10, 24, or sometimes more hours, just laying on the gurney. And these gurneys were not designed for pressure relief. So we need to take a look and see, take a look at the gurneys and take a look at the pads and take a look at those mattresses and make the personnel who work in the emergency rooms aware of pressure ulcer risk and get some pressure relief devices down there and upgrade the mattresses.
I totally agree with everything that's been said about the emergency room. We do tend to park our patients in the emergency room while we're waiting for inpatient bed placement. And when the hospital is full, it can be a long time that they're down there. One of the things we talked about doing in our facility is getting the emergency room to actually move the patient from the cart or the gurney onto a hospital bed once they got admission orders, because emergency rooms are not hospitals. They seldom have bathrooms nearby. Patients don't get care, they don't get turned, they don't get taken out of their street clothes, and we thought if we got the emergency room to put the patients in hospital beds, it would make them look like a hospital patient, and they could be turned more easily, they could turn themselves side to side and that sort of stuff. We haven't had great success with that. Our emergency room told us that, you know, they're an emergency room, and they don't have room for hospital beds, so we tried to, in the design of the new emergency room, put in a place for a holding area, you know, if you will, for patients that have admission orders to get out of the mainstay of traffic to make room for mother patients and to put them back on the back in their hospital beds. And it's worked fairly well, but we still have problems with just the conceptualization of what's the purpose of the emergency room. So we're a long way from getting there. We still have hospital-acquired pressure ulcers that started in the emergency room, and we haven't answered the whole problem yet.
You know, and by not addressing the emergency room, we're really losing major windows of opportunity. We have two sides of the spectrum. We may have the patient who comes in, who is at risk before they ever came in, that they may have a short stay in the emergency room, and that would have been our one window of opportunity to potentially educate the patient, the family, about pressure ulcer prevention and maybe to get them set up with home care services. We also have an opportunity there to educate our professionals who may not look at pressure ulcer prevention in that environment as being a part of their practice, and definitely it is. We also have the other side of the spectrum, our patients who come into the emergency room and stay in the emergency room, potentially for days, and are discharged from the emergency room. So our short-stay patients and our long-stay patients, I think pressure ulcer redistribution surfaces we have to look at, and, you know, as Dr. Black had mentioned, looking at having hospital beds come down to that unit. I've done the same, and where at all feasible and possible, you know, from a spatial point of view, we did actually have, for example, some of the low air loss beds down there. I've had air fluidized beds in that environment where at all possible, and then relooking at actually the stretchers and the pressure redistribution surfaces on those stretchers and use of heel offloading devices in that environment, getting your physical therapist down there if patients are in splints and maybe C collars because they've been in a motor vehicle accident. You know, there's many opportunities that I think the window is lost down there, and then the patient ends up having developed a pressure ulcer, and then they go up to a unit, and then up on the unit, that's when the skin gets inspected, and then the unit may assume the responsibility for the occurrence of that ulcer.
The next question is, what other treatments do you suggest for an open area on the buttocks? This facility has tried ProShield, Calmoceptine, Meplex Border, and Duoderm. The resident is on a turn and position schedule but is resistive to repositioning, preferring to place herself on her back despite pillows and wedges.
Well, you've mentioned a lot of great products, but even with any of those great products, or if you put all those products together, which we usually wouldn't want to do, but the basic problem that I'm hearing from that is that the patient's refusing to be off of the sat, and that is one of the most critical components to management, to prevention and treatment of pressure ulcers. So the patient's refusing to be off of the sat, you know, to investigate, why is it that they refuse? Are they uncomfortable in all other positions? And lying on their back is the most comfortable for that patient. Have we exhausted other pressure redistribution devices? Making sure that we're documenting with patients and that patient's family the ramifications of, you know, sustaining one position and the potential for pressure ulcer formation. Obviously, patients have rights, and not every patient is going to be adherent with what we think is the treatment plan, but we need to document everything that we've done and we've taught and find out from the patient perspective why is it that they're refusing.
The other thing I would add to that is I think you need to look at where the television is. A lot of times I think patients want to see the TV, and they're looking for the TV, and if it's only in one place, they can't find it, and so they turn themselves back to get to where they can see the television. And sometimes it's not a fixable solution, but if it's possible to turn the bed so the patient can continue to see the TV, that may be helpful.
Hey, Joyce, you just gave me a great idea. Why don't we invent a product with a rotating television?
Oh, you know what? We used to have those. We used to have IVs and everything else on rotating, you know, on a track up in the ceiling.
Uh-huh.
And the televisions today are fixed to the wall straight in front of the bed, and the patients can't turn. And actually, the Europeans told me that they don't have televisions in their patient rooms. If the patients are well enough to watch television, they can go out to the day room. So they think that we're causing the problem here in the States with all the televisions that we put, and we tend to put them in front of the bed when the patient's supine with the head of the bed up. So we're creating the situation position we don't want.
You raise an interesting point. Actually, what I've done in clinical practice is we move the bed where at all possible around the room so that we can get them in different positions. If we see that the watching of the TV one of the problems of, you know, the patient who keeps turning themselves back in the same location. And in some areas we do have actually TVs that move from side to side. They do actually move around the beds or the beds rotate in the rooms.
Right.
So, good point.
I have one more question, basically from a meeting I was at yesterday. It's that what products may a CNA apply with each brief change? Sometimes new products are introduced at a nursing home or a hospital. They come through the pharmacy, and first nurses are applying them since they say they're listed for stage 1 or 2 pressure ulcers. However, ultimately, they really are barrier creams for preventive skin care, such as Dermagram. How should policies be written to cover the change in use and allow a CNA to start using these products?
I think the policy needs to look at just the practicality of the fact that the CNA is the one who's cleaning the patient up and seeing the skin. And it makes no sense to leave the patient's skin unprotected while they're waiting for a nurse to be able to come down and apply the product. So I think with appropriate in-servicing for the CNA so they know how, particularly how much to apply, more is not better. It would be a fine policy to have in place to allow that to happen. You know, when we changed from Dial soap in all our bath water to other skincare products that we bathe with, we didn't assume that only nurses could apply it, even though there's lanolin and other products in the new bath products. So do the other panelists think differently that only nurses should be applying those?
No, for those types of topical agents, I would agree. I mean, obviously prescription items, you know, and I'm thinking growth factors and what have you, then it would need to be in the order to specifically be applied by, you know, whomever. But for your topical barrier ointments, your antifungal topical agents, those types of things, I think to say that your nursing attendants could not apply them, then they're not going to be applied with the frequency that they need to be, because the reality is the professional nurse is not going to be there every single time the patient's soiling and what have you. So I agree, it's education and it needs to be in the policy.
Okay, at this time, Sean, do you want to open it up for questions?
Sure, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. On the phone lines, if you have a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Again, ladies and gentlemen, to queue up for a question, please press star 1. Our first question comes from Laura Fogelman from Flushing Hospital.
Hi, hello to everyone today, and thank you for the presentation. I do have a comment on the regarding the question that was asked with the True Turn Elite mattress from Gamar.
Good.
We do have one. We have been trialing it for the past couple of months, and it seems to be very beneficial. The way the technology is designed, that the patient's can be turned up to 40 degrees, and this will aid with the pulmonary therapy and in addition to the wound management. And the patient will be turned in kind of like a log roll fashion, so it's very evenly distributed, so the entire patient will be turned. There's also a feature in the center of the mattress that is good for dressing changes. And that portion, which is like right under the buttocks area, can be deflated during the change for, you know, easily access to the wound. So right now, it seems to be doing very nicely. And in addition, the added benefit of, you know, having the nurse and the nursing attendant, you know, not incur any back injury or now, we all know that all healthcare workers have been, you know, shortened their career due to, you know, many back injuries. And one of the latest topics is the safe handling legislation for the healthcare workers. So it also is good for the patient and also good for the staff. And I would recommend it. There is a nice DVD that the company would supply, and it explains the you know, the bed and how it works, and I would recommend it.
How is this product being recommended? Is it being recommended as assistive to the healthcare professionals and nursing attendants for repositioning, or is it being recommended to basically replace the need for patient turning? How is it being, how are you being educated in its use? Because, again, I have not had the experience in using it.
Well, there is an option of the way it could be used. The patient can be turned every 2 hours, or even it could be set to be turned more frequently than that if necessary. So it's good for, we had piloted it in the pulmonary unit. So there was a little bit of difficulty with the fact that most of these patients are on vents. But it does not, you know, we had to, you know, educate the nurses and let them know that, you know, just because the mattress is turning the patient doesn't mean that you're not going to go in there and still make sure that, you know, the patient is properly positioned and, you know, all the tubings and everything are, you know, protecting the patient, not to, you know, have them be turning on any of these devices. So it doesn't, you know, eliminate the, you know, the fact that the patient still, of course, needs to be checked and properly positioned. But the heavy load and the easier access of having the patient moved, and the patients look very relaxed. You can see it's a very gentle turn. They actually look very comfortable when they're on this mattress. I don't know if that answered your question.
What happens? I've got a couple of questions. I've never seen it, and I appreciate you sharing your experience with it. What happens to the patient's head when they turn? Does the head stay, if the patient's comatose, does the head stay where it was? Does the bed turn that whole, the head?
The whole body, yes, the whole entire body. Like the head, everything will turn like a log.
Oh, okay.
So
my other question is, when you deflate the middle of the bed to change the dressing,
mm-hmm.
does the bed have enough power to reinflate the middle section, or does that stay deflated until the patient turns?
No. It that's just for the dressing change's purposes, and then it will go back to the once the dressing is completed, you can, you know, set it back to the. And it also has a feature for, you know, in case of. If they needed to do a coat or anything, it will become flat and harden the bed.
Okay.
There is a website that you can go on and see it, and I'm sure probably even request the DVD.
Thank you for sharing.
You're welcome.
I have to sign off because I'm late for my clinic.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Levine.
But I want to thank you. I think this was a great presentation, and I think Dr. Black, Dr. Baharastani, I really appreciate the opportunity to present with you.
Likewise.
Thanks, same.
Bye-bye.
Okay, signing off. Bye-bye.
Sean, are there additional questions?
I am not showing any other questions at this time.
Okay, then I guess at this point we'll take the time to end the conference. I want to hope that everybody enjoyed today's presentation and found it to be informative. Our next conference call will be Wednesday, October 14th at 9. I hope you'll all be able to join us. I also like to remind you to please fill out the evaluation form and send it back to us at the number that's listed on the bottom of the page. And again, to thank Dr. Black, Dr. Levine, and Dr. Baharastani for taking the time out to participate in this conference. Thank you all for listening, and hope you can join us in October.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for your participation in today's conference. This does conclude the conference. You may now disconnect. Good day.